it is, and we have quite a researcher with us. Stanton Friedman, always good to see you, Stanton.
Nice to see you, Jerry.
Kind of on your home territory.
Well, it almost seems like a second home to me, I guess.
You are the premier researcher, as far as I'm concerned, on the crash at Roswell.
At least I was the first one, anyway. Civilian. Yeah. Civilian.
You've been busy already. You've been lecturing every day. You've got a big conference this afternoon. What particularly were you talking about this time around?
Well, on Thursday night, they told me that the theme of the conference was the 1940s. I didn't wear any old ties or anything. I could probably find one. But my lecture was the Roswell incident in the context of the 1940s. And trying to point out, since so many people who come here weren't alive in the 1940s, especially in 1947, how the world has changed, how much it has changed since that period of time. And young people don't realize what a mess the world was in after the war was over. You know, the Marshall Plan started just the month before the Roswell incident. And I started asking questions, you know, how many of you have computers? 95% at least. Of course, there were no home computers back then, and there were no microwaves back then, and there was no birth control pill back then, and there was no manned space program, and there were no jet aircraft, and there were no fax machines, no internet, no VCRs. And then I try to tie those differences into some of the situations that happened. For example, the rancher Mac Brazel in 1947 didn't have a phone, didn't have electricity. He could not run down to the corner store because he didn't live near any corner of any kind. He's off in the boonies out here. And all the way down the line, if that happened today, you know, CNN would be here with cameras in 5 hours, you know, but not back then. And that was fun kind of thing. And
it took him a while, actually, to get into town, if I remember correctly.
Well, yeah, it was a long trip. What a lot of people are surprised by, I've had people show me a map, city map of Roswell. What corner did that, did that crash occur? I said, about 80 miles northwest of there. The ranch was not on a road. People always want to go out there. You know, give me directions. I say, I can't give you directions. I don't even have the GPS coordinates. It's not open land. The ranchers are very concerned about the fragility of their landscape out there. And the only way, remember that Major Marcel and Colonel Cabot were able to get there was to follow the rancher back. Because the last 10 miles are cross country. And if you don't know where you're going, you get lost out there.
When you first saw the location, how did you find it? I mean,
somebody from the museum took me out. He had permission. He knew how to unlock some of the gates. The Bureau of Land Management operates a lot of the land out there, and so I try to discourage people actually from going up there for a couple of reasons. One, it isn't safe. You really need a four-wheel drive vehicle for that last 10-15 miles. Two, there are rattlesnakes and scorpions there. Now, Easterners may not be accustomed to looking for them, but they are there, mm-hmm. I guarantee you. Three, they need to respect the land. And remember that there's at least 20,000 square miles around here that looks exactly like the land where it crashed. There was nothing special there. You want to film a simulated crash?
You could do it anywhere.
Yeah, 5 miles from here you could do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and also I once took with Bruce, the man from the museum who takes people out there when they go, we took five Japanese journalists out. We went 54 miles, broad daylight, without seeing a person or a vehicle.
Wow.
You can't do that in Japan. I mean, it just doesn't work.
It was probably pretty incredible to him.
Well, yeah, the journalists, if you don't come down here, you don't get a sense of how big the place is. I once had an English woman journalist call me, and, you know, she was perturbed. I don't understand why you don't just drive your car up there, park it alongside the road, take a metal detector in, and find some pieces of wreckage. I said, it's a great idea, except there's no road. What do you mean there's no road? Of course there's a road.
Yeah.
And I'm talking to her. Finally, I said, look, you don't seem to understand how different New Mexico is from England. New Mexico is twice the size of England and Wales combined. You had 50 million people. They had 1 million people. Does that tell you something about there's a little difference? And so it's hard. I took a German journalist. He was a science editor for Der Stern. He used to be an astronomer. I picked him up in Albuquerque, brought him on down, and he couldn't get over, most of the way it was dark, how clear the skies were. There was a comet in the sky then. Naked eye viewing, no problem. You could see stuff on the horizon. He says there's no place in Europe where you can see things as clearly on the horizon as you can here. And what also impressed him, you know, it was almost like, are we there yet?
Yeah.
You know, mile after mile after mile.
It's kind of the feeling I had when we were driving into Roswell, as a matter of fact.
That was exactly the situation. And so I got a lot of people who don't seem to understand that there really is a difference. And the rancher's son, Mac Brazel's son, Bill, who died a little over a year ago, he told me when I was with this German editor, the thing that bothered him the most is here come these journalists, so-called, from far away, and they're basically calling him and his father liars. He had handled some wreckage, too. And you don't call a person a liar in New Mexico very easily.
No.
You better justify that. A man's word is his bond here.
Mm-hmm. This is the West.
Yeah, it really is the West. And some people have a totally distorted view of what went on. They're all making this up. They're looking for attention. The sheriff was a redneck. He wasn't a redneck. He had a college degree. Both his daughters have college degrees. One of them had three kids with 5 degrees amongst them. I mean, they like it out here. Sorry, folks. There are people who like living out here, where Mother Nature runs the show. The weather's pretty nice, too, actually. You know, 100 during the day, 65 at night. I can handle that.
Yeah, it's nice. You know, when you go out there, Stanton, and like you say, it's just like 20,000 other miles, square miles around here. And you've investigated this for years and years now.
Starting in the 70s.
And that was an interesting story, and we still have that on our website, that original story about you telling me how you were down in Louisiana. And
yeah. Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Of all places, and came across...
The station manager at a television station, who was a little impatient, not with me, but I was supposed to do 3 interviews at his station. I did the first 2, and the second reporter was nowhere to be found. No cell phones back then. And he's apologetic. He's looking at his watch. He knows I have places to go. He knew the person who brought me to the station. Out of the blue, he says, you know, the guy you ought to talk to is Jesse Marcel. Brilliant investigator that I am. I said, who's he? Oh, we handle pieces of the wreckage of one of those saucers you're interested in when he was in the military. Wow. Tell me more. You know, the lie.
Right.
Lives over in Houma. I didn't know where Houma was. We're old ham radio buddies. And as it turns out, as I found out later, Jesse hadn't really told him anything. He'd seen the story in the New Orleans paper and had asked Jesse. He had moved back there. He's from Houma, and he got out of the Air Force. He moved there. And the guy asked him, ham radio, now what about that saucer? I can't talk about that. So I was just very lucky. And the next day I called Jesse from the airport, and that got the ball rolling. Now, the funny thing is, of course, he didn't have an exact date. Not surprising, it was more than 30 years earlier, you know. And then I heard a second story in Bemidji, Minnesota, Bemidji State College.
And another long ways from Roswell.
Very long way from Roswell. And the couple came up to me after a lecture at the university there. It's the university now. Ever hear anything about a crash saucer in New Mexico? Well, yeah, I've heard some things. Tell me more. Their good friend Barney Barnett had quietly told them of stumbling across a saucer in New Mexico and seeing bodies. Jesse never said anything about bodies. So I got their name and number, shared them with Bill Moore, whom I'd known in Pittsburgh. He was living in Minnesota. And he had a third story. An English actor named Huey Green there was an article in the Flying Saucer Review, an early issue in the 50s. He was driving across from Los Angeles to Philadelphia and heard on the radio about a crash saucer in New Mexico. Expected there would be a big fuss in Philadelphia. Nothing. His son lived in Canada. We found him, could pin down the date, because it wasn't a trip you made very often back then. You can remember what the roads were like back then.
Long time before interstates.
Yes. It was late June, early July, 1947, so Bill Moore went to the University of Minnesota Library, started looking through the periodicals. There was the story. Verified everything Jesse had told us and gave us names. Colonel Blanchard, the man who put out the press release, Walter Haught, who's still alive down here, several other names. So from then on, we proceeded with great speed. By 1980, we talked to 62 people. And
well, I tell you what, we'll take a break and we'll come right back and talk to Stanton Friedman about the 62 people and the story about the bodies. I keep hearing stories about photographs, but I've never seen one. Maybe Stanton has. We'll be back in a moment. This is Jerry Pippin and the UFO Files. We'll edit those choked when you choked up.
Okay. I could barely talk yesterday, so.
Well, I get this every time I come here.
Dry throat?
Yeah. Stanton Friedman, when we went to the break, you said that you had talked to 62 people.
Bill Moore and I have. Uh-huh. That's when the first book came out, was 1980.
You probably talked to a thousand times that many.
Well, by 1985, the total was 92, and Lord knows what it is now. And the nice thing is about the people we talked to early on, there were no television cameras, there was no nothing. These were people you get a reference from A to B to C to D, and yeah, I remember this, or I remember that, or maybe somebody knows, and the wives keep Christmas lists.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones with the information where you find people. Remember, this is before CD-ROM phone books. So my phone bill, Bill's phone bill, were all running hundreds of dollars a month.
Yeah, it was before low rates, too.
Yes, yeah. Indeed.
Yeah.
And what happened then, after the 92 in the mid-1980s, I instigated the Unsolved Mysteries show about Roswell, which went on in 1989, and they did a great job. They brought in witnesses from all over, brought them right here to Roswell, and the show, when it ran, had 28 million viewers the first time around. And what was intriguing as heck was they didn't put in a toll-free number in the Roswell segment of the show. It's an hour show, half hour was Roswell, and there were two other segments. But they did include the toll-free number in the other two segments. And suddenly, they had dozens and dozens of phone calls about Roswell. And because I had instigated, I got access to a lot of those people. So the point is, none of those people talked about the book. They hadn't seen the book. But Uncle John, you know, Cousin Bill, Neighbor Joe had told them bits and pieces about it. Now, the kicker, though, is that now we get people who think they know something about the story. I had a man call me who told me he remembers when he was a kid in 1947. He had just been allowed to read the magazines and newspapers at the local library in Alabama, and he saw a picture on the front page of the local paper of the bodies and wreckage out in the desert. Headlines, front page.
Saw that in Alabama.
Yeah, and he named the newspaper. And I was very dubious because I've seen loads of newspaper articles about Roswell, never with any pictures out there. So I called the newspaper, got their librarian to do me a favor, and she dug out the article, and sure enough, there was a picture on the front page. The only trouble is, it was not taken out in the desert. There were no bodies. It was one of the pictures taken in General Roger Ramey's office in Fort Worth, Texas, that were shown all over the place. But I don't think he was lying to me. I think he believed it. So there are many people today who will tell you stories who may have compounded the truth No, they wanted to be there.
As a researcher, I know you can back this up. People, you think eyewitness is a great idea, but as time goes along, these eyewitness stories change.
Well, especially if they've heard other stories. Mm-hmm. They sort of add them all in together, you know. Maybe I forgot that. Yeah, that was probably true. You know, that sort of thing. I talked to a criminal court judge, and he didn't have jury trials. This is in Canada. But he said, eyewitness testimony is what you need in court cases. Rarely do you have DNA or something like that. However, he says, you cannot trust demeanor. Some people can talk very well, look great, and they're lying through their teeth. There are other people who don't come across so well but are telling the truth.
The truth, right.
And that's why we have a system that has a defense attorney and a prosecutor, and you try to back up and double around and check out and all those things. But it doesn't mean eyewitness testimony is useless. It means you have to be careful, validate, verify, all this kind of thing. And I often get asked questions where I say, it's in my gray basket. What do you mean? Well, I don't know enough to say whether it's yay or nay.
You know,
not black, not white,
right?
Gray.
You mentioned earlier that out here the word is your bond, and when you're questioning people as a researcher, I hadn't thought about it, but you probably have to be fairly careful not to leave the impression you're calling someone a liar.
Oh, you have to be. You ask for information so you could validate. The one who told me about the pictures, I told him, gee, I hadn't seen any such pictures, but what was the name of the paper? What town? You know, I didn't say, I don't think you're telling me the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Probably in his mind, he was telling me the truth, you see. That's the kicker.
As far as you know, there are no pictures of Agin bodies anyplace? Or
well, let's put it this way.
That you've seen.
I know of no unclassified pictures.
Okay.
I did talk to a gentleman who was a military photographer, who was called to, he had a high-level security clearance, and he suddenly was sent out to Roswell. The plane didn't land here in Roswell, it landed over in probably White Sands. Anyway, he came out this way, and his job was to go out to a site. There was a big tent, there were bodies in the tent. They had one of these cameras. Remember, you used to have those film...
Yeah, the press camera.
Yeah.
Yeah, with the slides and the Casey crime photographer, one of those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And his job, the guy would move around in the tent and would lift the flap, and he had to take pictures of the bodies that were there. But after each insert was used, the other guy takes it. So what I'm saying is, I talked to somebody who took pictures, but he doesn't have any, and I don't know where they are. And it's like people ask me, what's the craft made of? Like the government is sending me classified documents, you know, giving the results of their latest analysis.
Gee, I thought
sorry! I wish, but look, I worked under security for 14 years. So I know how security works. It's like some people seem to think that if a pilot takes a gun camera picture, that he takes the film and takes it to the drugstore, for goodness sakes. It's taken out by special people at the base. He never sees the pictures. Why should he? He doesn't have any need to know. So you do have to be careful. I'm not saying there are no pictures. I'm saying I haven't seen any. And all the classified stuff about Roswell, nobody has seen who's outside the security barriers, if you will.
Is it surprising to you that what's this, 47, this is 2004, that's
57 years.
That people still come up with new information like this Ramey photograph that was upside down, supposedly, or they can make it up with the computer. I talked to Rudiak about that at one time.
David Rudiak did a splendid job on that. I was the first guy to get those pictures printed from the Fort Worth Star-Telegram back in 78 or so. And so I have prints made from the original negatives, which weren't scratched. Now, of course, the photographic material was donated to the University of Texas at Arlington, and loads of prints have been made, and you can see the difference, scratches on the negatives and so forth. But I showed up my lecture here the other night, an enlargement made from the original negative of that Ramey memo. And anybody who says there aren't words there is crazy. You can see that it's words. It's, you can't read them easily. David did the work on reading them. He also made use of computer techniques that didn't exist back then. You can get a list of, you can pick out three letters of a word, you know, V blank, C blank, something. You can dump it into the computer and it'll tell you all the words that have that combination. And if it's a choice between virgins and victims, you'll usually pick victims, I think, in a memo being held by an Air Force general. So he did a splendid job. You know, the funny thing is the Air Force said, we showed those pictures to another agency, and they didn't find anything. They've got a long history of lying, and I said this the other night. I wish I could find Colonel Weaver. He's the disinformation specialist, literally, who wrote the Air Force report, UFO crash at, let's see, UFO crash at Roswell, something like that. Fact versus fiction in the New Mexico desert. He provided the fiction without even batting an eye. For example, just to illustrate that, he said that the original story came out when the National Enquirer carried an article in 1978 in which Major Jesse Marcel claimed that he had recovered the wreckage of a flying saucer in 1947. Now, how would the Enquirer get the story unless the Major had gone to them? Also in 1978, he says, Stanton Friedman, a UFO researcher, can't call me nuclear physicist, you see. That would be against the rules. Visited with Marcel and started looking for other witnesses. Well, the fact of the matter is the article didn't appear until 1980. I know because I was the one who gave the Enquirer reporter, Bob Pratt, who'd written some excellent stuff, contact for Jesse because we'd already talked to those 62 people. The first book was due out at that time. So sounds like he's, and other people picked up on this tabloidization. I don't know if there is such a word, but
I like it.
It's useful. But in another place, he quotes from an FBI memo and leaves out, he doesn't show it, leaves out a clause that says which telephonic conversation had not borne out something about looking like a balloon. He leaves the qualifier out. The qualifier changes the meaning to exactly the opposite of what he leaves in there.
Well,
that's dirty pool.
You know, there are experts at that, though.
Yeah. Well, the same thing happened in the second report, the Roswell report, case closed. In the first report, they said they weren't going to say anything more. Well, they lied about that, too. And the second one, this is the one with the crash test dummies. They show a map three times in the report of all the places they dropped the crash test dummies. The interesting thing is that, of course, neither of the two crash sites had any droppings near them. It's like they avoided dropping near them. Beyond that, of course, I talked to the man who was in charge of the program. None of the crash test dummies were dropped before 1953, only 6 years later. We got time travel for crash test dummies, you understand. And secondly, I was informed by the man in charge that, hey, the dummies were 6 feet tall and 175 pounds.
Well, they weren't that big, I don't think. The crash dummies, were they?
The crash test dummies were that big,
but I mean
the alien bodies were not.
That's what I'm trying to say. We're going to let you go here in a minute. We'll be back and wrap this up.
Let me give my website.
We're going to do one more segment. Okay. We'll talk about your website, and then we'll let you go. So I know you've got a lot of things to do.
Yeah.
This is Jerry Piffin. This is the UFO Files.
I
had your kitchen. That's fine. We'll edit it. Let's go now and do about 6 minutes. Do 6 minutes. And then Stanton's got to go. We're talking with Stanton Friedman here at the UFO Research Center, the International Museum, and this is quite a library here, Stanton.
It's bigger than mine, I'll tell you that. Yeah. I got a big one.
let's talk a little bit about what you're doing these days. Your website is always interesting. Let's talk about that.
It's www.stanfriedman, FRIEDMAN.com.
And, of course, we have a link on our website to it and right by this interview as well. And
the newest thing on there, incidentally, is a paper I did just a few months ago update on the Majestic 12 documents.
Yeah, I wanted to get to that before you got away from me here.
And I found new evidence just last November, as a matter of fact, at the Eisenhower Library. I'm not saying all the documents are legitimate. As a matter of fact, in this paper I demonstrate at least seven, probably a lot more, are phony, because they show an original and an emulation and so forth. But the new evidence that I found, one of the noisiest arguments against the legitimacy is that it says briefing officer Admiral Roscoe H. Hillenkoetter, but he was only a rear admiral. Obviously, this is a phony document. Well, if you look at the list of the members of Operation Majestic 12, they use generic ranks for all the military people.
I don't think it's necessarily to refer to Brigadier General and Major General.
They don't.
Yeah, right.
Or full admiral, rear admiral, vice admiral.
Right.
But when I was at the Eisenhower Library, I dug out, after talking to the archivist, a number of MEMCONs, they're called, meetings at the White House, mixed to civilian and military, and a Brigadier General Andrew Goodpaster, who was Ike's staff secretary, attended these meetings, and he would write up, I won't call them minutes, but a report on the meeting, 2 to 6 pages, up through top secret, these were some of them. And he would list the attendees at the beginning. They were a mix of civilian and military. All the military rankings were generic, including for himself. General Goodpaster. It is signed Brigadier General Goodpaster. And I asked two archivists separately, does that bother you, this generic rank? No, that's the way they did things. Mm-hmm. So here's a guy claiming that that proves the documents are fraudulent, and it does no such thing at all. So I'm still hot on the trail. We are finding other things. Some of the later documents are indeed phony, and I've demonstrated that, not by claiming it, well, they're obviously fake, which is easy to say, much harder to demonstrate, but by showing why they're fake, specific things that are wrong. So it's still a puzzle, it's still exciting, and I'm very pleased that in Canada, the Space Network ran a film, Do You Believe in Magic? M-A-J-I-C.
Mm-hmm.
My book is Top Secret,
yeah, right.
M-A-J-I-C. And they had one of the noisiest negativists about the documents and me. We didn't do it together. He filmed him and he filmed me, and it was like point counterpoint back and forth. And I think we clobbered him because I could put the facts on the table and demonstrate. Like one other thing that many people are bothered by, the fact that the document lists Dr. Donald Howard Menzel, a Harvard astronomer, as a member of MJ-12. Impossible. He was a total skeptic. Wrote three anti-UFO books, gave all kinds of papers. Well, I had discovered in a visit to Harvard that required that I get permission from three different people, and looking at his papers, that he led a double life. He wrote Jack Kennedy. He had the longest continuous association with the National Security Agency with anybody in the country.
Wow.
30 years, including the Navy group. He was a cryptographer. He taught cryptography. He did classified work for the CIA and for 30 other companies. There's a whole bunch more. But some people don't want to believe that. He couldn't lead a double life. Remember Kim Philby and Burgess and McLean, the three guys who worked in English intelligence but were Russian spies?
Mm-hmm.
People do lead double lives. And a close friend of Menzel's, when I asked him about this, I said, how do you feel? Could Menzel have handled, you know, lying in his books and knowing the truth? He laughed and he said he would have loved it. He had a big ego. He was on the inside.
Yeah,
and he was fooling all these other people.
I could certainly understand that. That would be probably a challenge for him.
Yeah. And so I keep getting these attacks. I'll mention one other one. There's a memo from Robert Cutler, who was Ike's National Security Advisor, to General Nathan Twining, a member of the MJ-12, very distinguished military career. Was chairman of the Joint Chiefs by the time he was finished. And the security marking on it is top secret restricted, which is sort of a weird, should be top secret code word or just plain top secret. And everybody's screaming, oh, they didn't use that. It was not in use at the time. Obviously, it's a fraudulent document. Well, the General Accounting Office, which was looking for Roswell stuff because of Representative Steve Schiff from here in New Mexico, they put out a 400-page report of all the stuff they did. It's dull. But on page 80, they were at a certain facility looking at documents up through top secret, and they didn't find any Roswell material. However, they noticed several instances of the use of top secret restricted, even though we had been told, Majestic 12 in parenthesis, that it was not in use at that time. So I talked to three different people from the GAO. How do I get copies? You can't. They're still classified, Stan. We couldn't make copies for you.
Well, and we are going to wrap this up, but I got a couple of questions to ask you. So the first thing I'm going to ask you before anything, what's new with you? And then I got to ask an Eisenhower question. I guess I should ask an Eisenhower question first. What about, did he go to Edwards Air Force Base and have that famous meeting with the extraterrestrials?
I don't know. I do know that Bill Moore did a lot of checking on that story. For those who aren't familiar with it, Ike seemed to have disappeared for a period of time. There was even a quick news report that he had died. And the press secretary's running around. The guy's, you know, Ike's health was in question a bit. And supposedly he had worked on one of his tooth caps. Right. And so Bill managed to find the wife of the dentist. The dentist was dead. And she had no recollection of her husband working on the president. You'd really think she would, wouldn't
you? Yeah, you would think so. You'd think he'd be on the list.
There were all
Christmas
kinds of
cards, et cetera.
Yeah, there were all kinds of thank you notes that, you know, when a president goes somewhere, people like to get thank you notes. There wasn't one to him. His medical records at that time, and they keep detailed records of presidents, no indication of that either. That does not prove he met with aliens. It means he could have. And people may not be aware, there's a book, Ike Spies, by Stephen Ambrose, great historian. And it's clear Ike was right in the middle of intelligence work. You know, he approved every single U-2 flight. He had the final say on that. He didn't delegate that to other people. So it's possible, whether it happened, I don't think we'll ever know.
Now, the other question I want to ask you, what about, is there a Magic 12 now?
Well, I think there is a Majestic 12 with a different name. It's standard practice when code names get compromised that they be changed so that nobody will recognize anything new. And so wherever it is, I don't know. If there wasn't one, we should have one. When you start looking, there's all kinds of information being generated under security all the time. Uncorrelated targets in the sky. The newspapers don't get lists of how many times jets get scrambled to go after them. All the measurements made by the sophisticated equipment on board our aircraft, chasing UFOs, monitoring them from the ground, where's that data going?